So for people who don't know me, I'm Dan Middleman. Great to be here again. I was a grad student here, actually. And so it's very fun to be here, and thanks for the opportunity to speak. I really appreciate it. So I was a grad student here in Sophinia's lab, so I was doing kind of small electric scattering, so it's like kind of soft matter physics, but semi-biophysics stuff. And then I did a postdoc in Tim Mitchison's lab at Harvard Medical School, which is real sub-biology. And now I have my own group in Harvard at the main campus, and I'm in applied physics. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to use kind of physical, biophysical approaches to look at spindles. And so like what I'm going to do is I'll both kind of give you an introduction to spindles, and some of the stuff which, kind of motivation for stuff which we're doing. And I'll talk about one specific project we have some results on. So the specific project I'm going to talk to you about, this is really the kind of baby of Jan Bruges, who's a postdoc in the lab. And he really did all the experimental work and all the theoretical work that's relevant to this. He was assisted in this project by Valeria Muzo, who's a postdoc with Eric Mazur, and they helped with setting up the laser ablation and performing the laser ablation experiments. So first of all, I'm just going to give an intro to like spindles and microtubules and what my lab works on, and then I'll talk on about this one specific project. It's kind of like one specific story. Okay, so I'm going to start very basic, because I'm not sure, it's always tough, to know where to start. But like, so cell division, people don't know, is important.
What is Stasis? Is German security Stasis?
Well, no, so like every person, like.
Can you shift a little so we can, we don't screen the screen? Don't pull too hard. No, I mean,
cell division is important, and there's a lot of it. So every person in this room starts life with a single cell, and now you have about 10 to the 13th cells, so it's a lot of division. About every second, 10 million cells in your body die, and those are replaced by division, right? So a lot of division going on. And so as everyone knows, when cells divide, an important part is that each of the daughter cells, for the most part, need to have a complete copy of the genetic material. Every second. Every second, that's a 10 million divisions. So, that's a lot. When cell divides, each of the daughter cells need to have a complete complement of all the DNA.
So the DNA. So if you tear 2^10^7 is a huge number. But how do you, I'm trying to understand.
So these are two different kind of like facts. This is like, one is that you started life as a single cell, and now you have 10 to the 13th cells. So that's kind of fact one, right? Fact two is that as you're sitting here, there are cells in your body which are dying, and other cells which are dividing and replacing those cells.
So basically the same number of cells dies in there.
And so now if we kind of like, you're more or less at steady state, let's just pretend. It's not entirely true, but like, to first approximation.
What lifetime of each cell is about
10 days.
Those
numbers probably
10
days.
So obviously, this depends very much on cell type. It's not that like every cell. Different cells in your body are very, very different, and only certain cells. But for example, bone marrow. I think is one of the ones which turns over fastest and stuff like that.
Nevertheless, on average, the cell should divide once in 10 to 6 seconds.
Yeah, it's 1.5 months approximately, depending. Some cells are faster, right? If I remember correctly.
Yeah, which is 10 to the power of 6.
It's exponential.
Divided to the power of 6 seconds is 1,000 hours.
Okay, so I don't know. Same rate.
Okay, so the next step is just to say that, okay, so like, you know, like it's important for the daughter cells to have the DNA, and so this requires the DNA to be duplicated and then segregated. So I'm going to be talking about the segregation part, right? So in eukaryotes, the segregation is carried out by the structure called the spindle. And so the spindle assembles when it's needed, and it's responsible for dividing the chromosomes, and then disassembles. And so cell division can be divided into different stages based on kind of essentially the changing shape of the spindle. When you have what's called prometaphase, that's basically when the spindle is forming. When you have metaphase, you have a fully assembled spindle with the chromosomes in the middle. And when you have anaphase, that's when the chromosomes start to divide into what will eventually become the two daughter cells. All right. So I'll show you a movie of this process, which was not taken by myself. So we're not going to see the spindle directly, but rather what we're going to, this is phase on microscopy. Here's time here in minutes. And so what we see, here's the nucleus. This is a big cell. And now you can see chromosomes. So they've condensed, and so you can see individual chromosomes. And now we're in prometaphase, and the spindle is forming, and the chromosomes start starting to line up. So this guy hasn't quite lined up yet, and so the spindle's like, you know, trying to align it. And then eventually it gets that guy too. And now we're in metaphase. And then anaphase. So that was like, you know, an hour. Okay. Say again?
It's quite impossible.
Right, and so you know, okay, so that's an example of successful cell division, and as I'm sure you can imagine, if cell division doesn't work successfully, it's very bad. In other words, errors in cell division can cause disease. And so there's some birth defects which are definitely due to missegregation of chromosomes. And there's a lot of thought that cancer could be caused by kind of errors in cell division, but that's somewhat more controversial. But a lot of chemotherapy agents work by directly targeting the spindle, right? So the structure I tell you about. And this is because, you know, like cancer is like, you know, cells dividing when they shouldn't be dividing. So if you kill spindles and you kill dividing cells, and therefore, you know, like that's good to fight cancer. So it's medically important to understand this as well. Okay. So the spindle is, so this is what we're going to be talking about mostly, right? Is the spindle, particularly like the metaphase spindle, which is this, you know, I often say like football shaped structure, but it depends what country you're from, whether this is a football shaped structure or not. So the chromosomes are in the middle, and basically the most of the spindle is made up of microtubules, right? So microtubules are these polymers, one thing which is very important in general, and in particular for what I'm going to talk about later on, is that they're polar polymers. So the two ends are not the same, right? They have what's called a plus end, which in this case is where the arrow is, and a minus end, which is the kind of the blunt end. So the microtubules are composed of tubulin, which is a protein subunit, which self-assembles into the microtubule, which is this, you know, polymer, which is basically this hollow tube, and so it's more or less like a crystalline lattice. And of course, you know, this asymmetry comes from the fact that the tubulin subunit itself is asymmetric. Okay. All right, there are at least two classes of microtubules in the spindle, so there are a huge amount of these polymers. There are at least two different classes you can think about. One would be what's called kinetochore microtubules, which are microtubules which contact chromosomes in a special region called the kinetochore. And those ones are mostly responsible for like moving chromosomes around. And then there are the non-kinetochore microtubules, which have kind of other responsibilities. And one of the main things that they do is that they help make spindle structure. And that's a lot of what I'm going to talk about. And so it's like it's these non-kinetochore microtubules which basically more or less establish the bipolar nature of the spindle. And so in many cases.
And actually, how does it differ? Is there anything chemically different, or is it the same?
So essentially, what the thought is, it would be that microtubules whose plus ends touch the special, you know, like region here, which is this, the kinetochore, which is this giant protein complex. due to some interaction, they're stabilized. But exactly what's going on right there is not well understood, and it's kind of a hot area of research currently. And so this depends very much. And so that also depends very much on organism and stuff. And so, for example, typical size you might think of would be a couple hundred nanometers. But that's not kind of universal. So, for example, humans and a lot of organisms which we care about have what's called point kinetochores, which means that this drawing is accurate. We have a kind of more or less little region here. But other organisms like C. elegans, which is a prominent model system, they have what's called holocentric kinetochores, which means that the entire side of the chromosome is like one big kinetochore. So the kinetochore is basically the size of the chromosome. But that's kind of less typical, but it happens.
Yeah. I was wondering, can you have a steady state population where a single microtubule could be a part of the non-kinetochore population and then switch to a kinetochore population?
Yeah, and so it's certainly the case. The exact dynamics of microtubules in the spindle and the hole isn't well understood, and this is largely what I'm going to be talking about. And in particular, at the kinetochore, I would argue, so other people disagree with me, but I argue this is really not well understood, but it's almost certainly the case, it is the case that there is turnover here, and so presumably microtubules are becoming attached and detached, and so in that sense, they're kind of switching populations. Yeah. And so again, it depends on organisms certainly, but kind of for typical humans and other things that you might care about, there's probably 10 or 20 per, kinetochore.
And in terms of the center of the
non-kinetochore, because right, and so this I'll come to again, and so this depends on the organism again, for kind of a typical human tissue culture cell, there'll be thousands or 10,000 microtubules. And then for meiotic spindles, which is what I'm actually going to talk about, it's probably 100,000 microtubules, so it's a lot.
And there is one kinetochore per chromosome.
Exactly. And I think there's some bizarre cases there could be more, but that's kind of like the standard thing, yeah. Okay, and so just to remind people, just in case they've aren't familiar with microtubules. So microtubules polymerize in a very bizarre fashion, and so it's a regular kind of polymer, a chemical polymer you might think about. Its end would do kind of a random walk with time because you just guys fall on, right? So you can polymerize microtubules just with pure tubulin, and that's not at all how they behave. And so you can follow individual microtubules growing and shrinking. And if you look at their length as a function of time, you can see that they tend to be in a growing state where thousands of subunits will add, and then they suddenly switch to a shrinking state where thousands fall off, right? Okay, and so this is called rescue and catastrophe. And so this is based on hydrolysis of GTP, so it's a non-equilibrium, process. And so the basic kind of picture. So I normally say that there's no good microscopic model of dynamic instability, but it may be the case that there will be one or is one. but the basic kind of cartoon people have in their head is that tubulin subunits can be in kind of two states: one where they want to be in a microtubule, and those are the soluble guys, and they want to be in a microtubule. But then once they're kind of get inside the microtubule, then they go from GTP to GDP, in which case they don't want to be in the microtubule anymore. But then if something happens to this cap of guys who have GTP, if this cap is somehow broken, then the whole thing starts depolymerizing because all the guys on the inside don't want to be on the microtubule. But normally this cap would be here, so even though these guys want to depolymerize, they can't because you have this cap on top.
This is on the plus end.
Yeah, and so this would be the plus end. The picture would be essentially the same for the minus end, but besides all the rates and stuff are different. So the plus ends are often much more dynamic than minus ends.
What this cap is made of?
This isn't entirely clear in the following sense that one idea would be that it's really chemical, and that is that so you have subunits which have GTP. And other guys have GDP. And so what the cap is just tubulins who are bound to GTP. it's not clear if that's the whole story or if there's also actually kind of a different structure. There might be some kind of physical structure here, so not just kind of a simple chemical thing. So for example, often if you look at like EM images of growing microtubules, they form like sheets and other weird structures here. So if the cap is really kind of a physical thing or a purely chemical thing or some combination of the two, isn't
just a quick question to understand it better. Because this microtubule you're showing in that cap must be attached to something, right?
No. So the idea here would be like, let's say you have this thing, whatever, like spontaneously like nucleated in solution, and then you have these guys over here, and GTP wants to add to this cap and make the whole thing grow, and this will start growing, and then suddenly, you know, for whatever reason, maybe these guys all get hydrolyzed just stochastically, in which case the whole thing will start falling apart and then it will vanish. So it'd be something like that.
So when it's attached to a chromosome, it's going to be on plus and the kinetics are very different.
Yeah, no. So that's true. And right, so one thing, so I'll just come to that next point, and that is that, so like, if you look, so there are a huge number of proteins which modulate all this, and one way you can like recognize that is the following. I mean, this is just kind of like a phenomenological observation that this is tubulin in solution, you know, the length of the function time, and this is, I'm sorry, this is microtubule, you know, just from pure tubulin, the length of the function of time. And this is microtubules, the length of the function of time in actual, like, kind of cell extract, basically in the cell. And what you can see, so you have to actually, like, it's so different that you have to, like, blow it up and plot it on different length scale to even, like, see what it looks like. And this is because, like, the dynamics are strongly altered because there are a huge number of proteins which interact with microtubules and eventually modulate that process.
But there's still huge fluctuations.
Yeah, but there's still huge fluctuations, definitely. Yeah. I mean, and it's not clear, like, should we think of this as just kind of like the same thing with kind of different parameters, or should it really be something different? I would say that's not clear.
It looks it's symmetric, like the pure tubulin case.
That's right. So often people say, yeah, in many situations it looks like the rate of polymerization is sometimes more or less equal to the rate of depolymerization, which is unlike pure tubulin often. But pure tubulin even...
Because you're close to critical concentration in cells. This experiment is done at different concentrations.
Right, this is the other thing I was going to say, kind of building off of that, that like this would look very different depending on what buffer you do it in even. I mean, so it's like... And so even though people have done a lot of stuff on tubulin pure solution, we can't just extrapolate blindly from that to what's going on in spindles because there's all this crazy stuff that happens in cells. So that's kind of the take-home message.
Just a quick question. Does anybody know what the nucleus is? Like, what is the minimum critical size?
Oh, no. And so people have done very little stuff on nucleation. So nucleation is the least well-understood stuff in any sense. So either kind of like if you just take tubulin, how does that nucleate to form a microtubule? That's incredibly poorly understood. If you ask kind of in the cell what factors really regulate nucleation, that's very poorly understood. And if you ask kind of how is that spatially regulated to do cell biology, that's also fairly poorly understood.
And another question, in vitro, for example, can you actually grow a product element like without the full microtubule structure?
So like under different kind of salt conditions, you can get all sorts of kind of crazy things. Like depending on what salt you have, I mean, so like protofilms can sometimes form little rings, or they can kind of self-assemble to form like sheets. That's actually how the high-resolution structure tubulin was originally solved. Was people got into, you know, assembled to sheets, and they did like 2D electro, you know, crystallography. So. Okay. All right, so spindles, like I was saying before, can contain hundreds of thousands of microtubules. And so that's kind of illustrated here. So this is a spindle. This is a spindle which has done fluorescence microscopy. And a spindle like that, not literally that same spindle, what was done was that was embedded in plastic. It was fixed, embedded in plastic, and then cut into sections. And so a section was kind of cut like this and then rotated out toward you. And then put in an electron microscope, right? And so this was done by Peg Coughlin. So this is a cross section of the spindle. These are chromosomes. This is just lipids which kind of hang out around the spindle. If you zoom into this little block here, you see this block, You zoom into this little block here, you see this block. Now you can see chromosomes, and you see these little circles. And these little circles are the cross-section of microtubules that are pointing out at the board at you. Right? And so, you know, you can see in this block you have a lot of microtubules, right? Therefore, in here you have a lot of microtubules. And therefore, you know, in here you have a huge number. And so if you just estimate how many microtubules are in this cross-section of this one spindle, it's like about 20,000. So there are a lot of microtubules in these structures. And again, this depends on the exact spindle, but this is, you know, one, you know, from, again, one particular organism.
That area labeled as DNA, could you just specify a little bit?
It's basically a chromosome. This is part of a chromosome, so it should be, yeah, exactly, exactly.
And are most of them spanning the half length of this, or are there a bunch of shorter microtubules coming at us?
So this is what my talk is about. This is when I actually get into what we try to measure. That's an excellent question. What that doesn't reveal, those EM, is that microtubules are very dynamic in spindles. So this is a movie of that same type of spindle where, you know, again, 100,000 microtubules. We're now, like, the tubule is essentially heavily labeled, so this is about 1 in 10 monomers labeled. And you get a sense that there's a lot of motion here, but it can be a little hard to, like, interpret, you know, with this, like, very heavily labeled stuff. So an alternative way you can do stuff is that you can do single molecule imaging. So instead of labeling 1 in 10, you label like 1 in 100,000. So this is a spindle, and there's one pole here, and the chromosomes would be in the middle. And what you can see, so every dot here is a single molecule of tubulin, which is incorporated in the spindle. And so what you can see is that basically all the dots are moving, right? And so what that means is that, like, you have all these microtubules, and they're constantly sliding relative toward each other. So even though the spindle here is at steady state, it's in metaphase, it's not changing size or shape, all of the microtubules are constantly moving relative to each other.
It could be also monomeric, alpha tubule. I mean, it could be molecules in the solution, not...
No.
Those that don't belong to the microtubules.
No. And so because... The way kind of images like this are done, it takes about 2 seconds to, like, acquire an individual image. And in that 2 seconds, anything which is soluble diffuses around a huge amount, so you basically can't see it because the light from it is spread all out. So you only see guys who are essentially incorporated in microtubules.
What is the correlation about opposite motion? How, like, if you look it looks like some of them are moving one way, some of them are the other way, and what is the average distance between oppositely moving ones?
Okay, so that I haven't looked at, and that I don't know anyone who's looked at that directly. I mean, like, I'll make a statement, and then you can tell me if this is relevant to your. So it's certainly true that if you look in the middle, there's half moving one way and half moving the other way. As you go to the pole, there's clearly, like, you know, more moving here, but there are still some moving there. So there's some moving everywhere. I don't know, like, if you literally said, like, for a certain location in the spindle, what is the nearest? I mean, there's no particular indication that there would be much kind of spatial correlations on these kind of large optical length scales. But, like, I haven't actually looked, to be honest with you. So that I don't know. So, I mean, like, we did some stuff, like, looking at correlation, how are their velocities correlated with each other? I mean, like, not, like, based on this kind of opposite, not, like, positive and negative, but rather, like, is kind of, if one guy is moving kind of slightly faster or slower, does that say anything about a guy who's nearby moving faster or slower?
Sort of the same question.
Sort of the same, yeah.
It's the same.
Okay.
This is a two-dimensional projection. But if you have this confocal,
this is confocal. This is confocal.
It's confocal, so you do have all three dimensions.
Well, this is just kind of one 2D slice.
Yeah.
You have 3D information.
And so in that, so like, if you just look at kind of velocity, you know, or yeah, like, correlations, it basically falls off like 1 over R. Guys nearby, I mean, like, there's guys nearby, yeah, so there's correlation which, like, you know, decreases with like how far away you are.
And this is perpendicular or along?
Perpendicular, it basically is very nicely 1 over R. For a long, for kind of like distances less than a couple microns, it's more or less flat. And then it decreases, and it's hard to say exactly how it decreases because you don't have a lot of, you know, distances.
So what does the track of a single point look like? Is it moving sort of in steady drift? Is it fluctuating around?
And so one guy is more or less kind of moving downward. or, you know, moving in one direction, but there is clearly fluctuation. Yeah. And so there's kind of interesting things about what those fluctuations actually physically mean. But it's not clear right now, I would say.
Do they ever turn around and go down?
Yeah, no. And so sometimes you see them like jitter a little bit. I've never seen one go here and then go the other way.
Well,
that's related to the thing is that not only are they constantly moving, they're constantly turning over, right? So like an individual guy here or a lifetime of presumably an individual microtubule is probably of order 20 seconds. And so this whole structure exists at steady state for hours, okay? Or can, under certain circumstances, can exist at steady state for hours. But you have this constant motion and constant, very rapid turnover. So the lifetime of an individual microtubule is of order 20 seconds or so.
So they'll fall off and then you can't see them anymore or something.
And so presumably what it is, so what the interpretation is based on also other data, is that actually an individual microtubule itself, the entire microtubule, would be nucleated, grow and shrink, and then vanish. In that time scale for being nucleated and vanishing, you know, growing and shrinking and vanishing, is of order 20 seconds. Okay. So it's like huge, huge turnover, right? And it's not just all of these 100,000 microtubules that are turning over so rapidly, but it's more or less everything else. And so, like, you know, these motions are of course caused by the presence of other proteins, such as motor proteins, which cross-link microtubules, and those are also turning over with a time scale of, you know, whatever, you know, tens of seconds or less, or yeah.
Can you image those guys?
So people have. There's been a little bit of imaging of those guys, but it hasn't been fabulous, I would say. And there are a lot of those guys. There are a lot of different types of those guys.
So can you comment on the speed of precession of these individual tubules along the chromosome relative to the growth time of the chromosome? Presumably these are two different, quite different processes. Because you can grow and shrink a microtubule without moving a tubule.
That's right. So the movement is quite slow. And so the movement's of order 2.5 microns a minute.
Yep.
The lifetime, as I said, of one guy is of order 20 seconds or 30 seconds. The length of the spindle is 45 microns, so they don't move very far from where they're actually, you know, like, nucleate. The speed of growth of an individual guy is of order 10 microns a minute. So the speed of growth of the placenta is much faster than the movement of the guy.
And this movie, can you see which ones are part of the... Was it attached to chromosomes?
And so for this type of spindle, the vast majority of guys are not associated with chromosomes. It's probably 95% of the guys are not associated with chromosomes. So like it's hard. So basically probably all of these are not associated with chromosomes.
Are you going to go into this 1/r correlation?
So actually, I'm not going to talk about that today. But
it tells you something, right?
Yes, which is very interesting. That's right.
Maybe just a stupid question once more. These microtubules are quite long, right? Why do we see them at small spots?
Right. Okay. So what it is that most of the microtubules you can't see. But what you can see, there's a very small fraction of this, monomer, you know, we'll call it monomer, which is this tubulin, which is really a heterodimer. And these are labeled. So what you're looking at is an individual kind of like...
It's just labels.
Exactly. Labels. Yeah, exactly. Okay, and so there are, you know, a billion proteins which modulate how microtubules grow and shrink, how they nucleate, which slide them in different ways, or some motors slide anti-parallel guys relative to each other, some motors slide parallel guys, there are different cross-linkers, so there's a bunch of, you know, it's complicated. That's not known.
That's not known. If you label them, don't you see?
Well, so that's a little bit confusing, right?
Do like two different color labels, some for motor, some for microtubule, so you can color
colors. No, that's correct. But the standard way that someone would do that would be that you somehow add fluorescent, you know, like, yeah. And so then you have to start asking. In theory, one could, like, by doing those experiments, try to get at those things, but that really hasn't been done very well for much of anything.
The movie was that in Netflix, right?
Yeah, that was in metaphase.
If you look at it in anaphase, does it look very different? Like, do you have a problem?
And so in that system, that hasn't been done. So, like, I'd say people have it. So certainly, like, things move differently, and dynamics are very different in anaphase. I would say that there has not been a very good kind of, like, real characterization of precisely How it is different, but it certainly is very different.
Is it difficult to do your experiment in that?
And so for that thing, yes. And it's because of that, the particular kind of, well, I mean, I could get into that, but whatever. It's, yeah.
Thank you.
One more question. From your movie, if you were looking at mostly the big component of the motion is how long.
That's right.
Have you looked at the particular component, how random or how fluctuating is it, what does it tell you?
No, and so that I haven't looked at in detail, but there's certainly, I mean, it exists. Yes, yeah. And you can definitely even see those by eye. But like, yeah, I haven't analyzed it in detail.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's clear, I mean, obviously you can see it's much larger and kind of a long axis. Yes. But yeah, no, yeah, so that I don't know. No, but that's, I mean, obviously a very, very interesting question. Okay, another thing which I really want to kind of like hammer home is that the metaphase spindle, it's really a stable steady state structure, which is stable against perturbations. So like you can do experiments, like you can take a spindle, right, go in with glass needles. So I didn't, this is an experiment from this paper, and other people have done similar experiments. Go in with glass needles, you just cut off one of the poles, right, and throw it away, right? And over time, it'll grow back.
But you cut the cell out.
Oh no! So this is actually done in a cell extract. It's in the cell-free system. And so there's like cell goop. I'll come back to this in a moment. But like in this particular experiment, this is done in a system where you kind of open. It's like you have cell interior everywhere. It's like, you know, in a giant test tube. And here you have a spindle floating around, and you literally cut this pull off, throw it away, and it comes back.
And so how do you localize the pole now? What holds the ball in this system?
Right, and so this comes back to like, I mean, I believe this is certainly true in this system, and personally I believe it's true in nearly all systems, but it certainly hasn't been proven, that really what determines the size of the spindle is not, this is due to like internal, I don't know what you call it, like internal organization dynamics, not so much having to do with kind of forces on the cortex.
And the bulb that you cut and threw away grew another spindle?
No. So that just depolymerized and falls apart.
So how does the system decide which half will grow and which will?
And so I would say like rigorously it's not entirely clear, but the answer nearly everyone would give is that this is a half with the chromosomes. But I mean, like personally, I think it's a little complicated, but like that would be the answer that most people would give.
So it's the half which is attached to chromosome.
Yeah, but I don't know if like rigorously someone, I mean, because whatever, I mean, we can get into details.
Cell extract.
Say again, please?
You said it is
cell extract. Yeah.
So are you now saying that one then is attached to chromosome and the other?
No. So the chromosomes are in the middle. And then. And so here, like chromosomes would be like over here somewhere, something like that. And then this end falls apart and that end regrows. And yeah, another thing I should say is that there are proteins that specifically localized to this part here, and those of course come back over there, right, after they've fallen off. And so not only is it stable against kind of physical stuff, but also pharmacological perturbations. So you can start with a regular bipolar spindle, inhibit one of these motors, and you get an ester. And so now all the microtubules are kind of pointing outwards, right? And then under certain circumstances, this can be reversible. So in certain circumstances, you can kind of go back from this to that. So you have different steady state structures that you can be in. Okay, maybe I should go this another way, but this is kind of like the this is the cell-free systems which we use and many other people use to say spindle. So what you do is that you start with a frog, you know, you make it lay eggs. Each of these eggs, don't ask how. No. So you inject it with a compound, and this I love. So you inject it with a compound which originally comes from the urine of pregnant women.
What?
Yeah, and so like apparently this used to be used, so I'm told, as a pregnancy test. But like whenever I say that, I always like wonder like who like figured that out the first time, like. but anyways, you know, like it works, yeah. And so actually each of these eggs has a little spindle in it, and it's arrested in metaphase. It's ready to be fertilized. And so what you do is that basically, I mean, more or less, it's a little more complicated, of course, but like more or less, you kind of put these in a centrifuge tube, spin down, that pops them open. You know, like different components separate out at different layers. And there's one kind of like large layer, which is basically like cell interior, like cell goop. Right? You remove that, and normally, now that you've removed that, you actually, that does not have a spindle in it. That does not have DNA in it, but it's still biochemically in metaphase. And then if you add DNA, and you can even use essentially lambda phage DNA, like people have done this with lambda phage DNA on magnetic beads. And so, you know, like these, like, so it's nothing to do with the sequence of DNA, right? But somehow the DNA picks up the appropriate factors, which allows it to assemble a spindle, which as far as anyone can tell, is just like the spindle which is naturally in the egg. And so this is totally like, you know.
It's not, they're not in doublets. DNA is not divided, you're adding.
And so, yeah, so that totally doesn't matter. And so all that matters is that you have enough physical DNA. I mean, and somehow it has to be close enough and presumably long enough, but like.
They're separated into separate groups.
Yeah, and so, like, so I mean, if you add, so you have a chunk of DNA, which is because, so you can do different things. So the two standard things which people do is that you either add demembranated sperm from frog, in which case it's like kind of real, like, you know, like the right thing, and then that's fine, you get a nice spindle. But again, like I said, you can literally add magnetic beads coated with lambda phage DNA. So this has zero to do with like the actual frog. And still, it'll assemble a spindle which has the same morphology, same size of morphology.
So there is a concentration of tuberin monomers in the cell extract, right?
Yes, that's right.
Is it measured? What is the concentration?
And so it's like around 10 micromolar.
And, okay, and if you can leave it like a long time, microtubule will not start nucleating itself without any DNA?
That's correct. But don't forget, I mean, there's a huge number of other factors here. This is really like the inside of the cell, basically. And so there, yeah. So like, you know, microtubule dynamics are obviously regulated by, you know, like other factors.
This is the
layer
of frog.
Say again, please.
Is this the layer of frog?
Well, in practice, like one often uses DNA of the frog, but it doesn't have to be. It's like the sequence of the DNA is totally not relevant.
Would you say that macroregion of proteins are different in different animals? So I wonder.
Say again, please.
Did you say that these microtubules are attached to this macroregion of the proteins?
Yes, I'm sorry, because that's one point which I forgot to mention, which is very important. That the one thing which it is important to have the kind of the right DNA for is to have a correct kinetochore assembly. Okay, if you just put in random DNA, you will get spindle assembly, which has the same morphology, but it will not have functioning kinetochores. In order to have kind of, you know, kinetochores, then you need kind of like the right, you know, like the right thing. But like, again, having kinetochores or not having kinetochores does not have essentially influence on spindle morphology in the system.
DNA, so you couldn't use RNA.
No, you couldn't use RNA. I mean, so people have done a little bit of work where you try to use not the DNA per se, but some of the factors which DNA picks up and, you know, activates stuff. But like there hasn't been a huge amount of work on that. But I mean, you know, like on using that to assemble spindles, people have done some of that type of stuff. Okay. And so what the take-home message is that so the spindle is this non-equilibrium steady-state structure, right? So like, I, you know, was, you know, grew up in soft matter physics, and so like I want to think of like everything as being, you know, like self-assembly, like soft matter physics. But you know, it's really important to remember this is totally different from, you know, like, I mean, again, I'm sure people are familiar with this, but like, in like, you know, obviously in like, you know, like block copolymers or, you know, lipids, you know, they assemble to kind of minimize some free energy. The structure you get from the spindle, it's a steady-state structure, but it has nothing to do with minimizing a free energy. It's totally this highly non-equilibrium steady-state structure. So the thing which I'm really interested in is how can we understand this, and how does, you know, so how do we think about the steady state structure, and how does this structure arise from the behavior of the polymers, you know, which make the structure up, so microtubules. Okay, so that's like, you know, like largely what the big kind of question is for us. So it's totally not known. There's a wide range of models that people have proposed. Here's kind of like three random ones. So some people say, all right, the way the spindle works is that you have some scaffold which kind of holds microtubules and motors in place, and then that tells you kind of how to, you know, build the spindle. And other people say, no, this kind of spindle matrix doesn't exist. What goes on is that you have diffusible signals coming from chromosomes. So the chromosomes kind of send out diffusible signals which modulate the dynamics of microtubules and other things. And then somehow gradients in these signals are responsible for the size and shape of the spindle. But it's not all clear that's correct. And therefore, like another possibility is that essentially it's just a spontaneous organization of microtubules and motors and other things. So no kind of global, you know, blueprints. Somehow you just magically get the spindle.
But from what you described, it looks like you could already separate some of those.
It's tough because there's always like caveats to everything, right? Because for example, personally, like I favor this, and I think maybe there are aspects of this which are correct, but others which are wrong. But it's like other people would really disagree with me, and it's really not. I mean, it hasn't been established.
What's it known about the poles? I mean, the pole you haven't talked about those at all.
Right. And so again, that can be very different in different systems. In kind of a typical mitotic cell, there's a structure there called the centrosome, which is involved in nucleating microtubules. But for certain systems, for example, for female meiotic systems, like these egg extracts are, they actually don't have centrosomes, and they still have a pole. And for even systems which do have centrosomes, it's not at all clear how really important they are for poles. Spindle. So for example, there's kind of classic experiments where what you can do is that you have a bipolar spindle with centrosomes at the pole, you go in with a laser and you blow up the centrosome and you still have, you know, a bipolar spindle, right? And so it's like the kind of the connection between the pole and the centrosome for kind of normal mitotic cells is not entirely clear.
So by signals, you mean some kind of mechanical signals or what?
No, and so what the model is, and so without getting into any details, it's really that you have some soluble molecule which floats around and gets activated when it hits chromosomes, and then it can diffuse off in its activated form and kind of like activate other things downstream to like regulate microtubule stabilization and nucleation and stuff like that. In motor activities, and then somehow that gets deactivated, like, you know, with time, and therefore you would have locally some kind of different, you know, stuff going on around chromosomes. And there'd be different versions of this. Like the most strong version would be kind of like the spatial scale upon which this kind of activated molecule converts to the non-activated form would somehow, that would tell you the size of the spindle or something like that. Like, so that would be like the strongest like version of that.
Which of course doesn't work at all. We should just dump in lambda phage DNA and it does the trick.
Well, no, because then the picture would be lambda phage DNA picks up these factors which are involved in activating other things, right? So. Okay, and so one of the things which we're involved in, which I'll tell you a little about, is that, so I think one reason why it's hard to distinguish any different things is because behavior of microtubules and spindles are poorly understood, so we don't know really where nucleation is happening. It's not really clear. Polymerization, depolymerization, there's whatever, it's not entirely clear, cross-linking motion, all this stuff. What are the lengths of microtubules, and this will come to again, and the extent to which these are spatially regulated isn't, you know, currently known. Okay.
At length, you can see from those trajectories.
No. Because okay, so the model you have in your mind then is a treadmilling model. So what you're thinking, presumably, I'm trying to read your mind, but like, a tubular subunit appears on one end, kind of treadmills through the other guy, you know, to the other end, where it kind of falls off. And so therefore the length of time that you're, you know, kind of associated with the spindle would tell you the length of an individual guy. I'm assuming that's kind of the model that you're thinking.
When you choose your label concentration properly, you can see the number of labels moving in the same direction or the same speed, and so from that you can figure out.
Oh, yeah, and so that's very difficult because of course everything's interacting with each other. So it's not clear, you know, like, and so people have tried to do precisely that, like look for correlated motions and argue this means that they're in fact on the same microtubule. That's very tricky because again, everything's interacting with each other, so there's correlated motions, you know, so yeah. And so just one indication, I just want to nail home one thing, and this is related to another question before, is that, so people who are familiar with the spindle might have, you know, seen like kind of textbook pictures like the following, where all microtubules extend, you know, they have their minus ends at the pole and the plus ends in the middle, and they're essentially the very sharp distribution of lengths, and this is kind of the standard textbook view. And while there are certainly elements of truth in this type of picture, I would say that or I would argue that this is not correct for any spindle, really, even though there are elements of truth in it. And certainly for some spindles, for some larger spindles, there's evidence that a kind of a more accurate picture is something like the following, that in fact, like, you have a lot of short microtubules, which are in fact spread all throughout. So it's more like you have like a pneumatic of like you know, little microtubules, something like that.
Are you suggesting there's just a factor of 2 difference, or are you saying there's like a factor of 100 difference in terms of the dispersity? Because talking about the dispersity of the spindle length.
And also location of plus and minus end.
And so it's a factor. So are you arguing that there's a factor of 2 wrong with this picture?
Well, there's a factor of like 10 or 100. Well, okay, so at this point, and so I'm going to come to this later, but at this point, all I'm saying is that, like, qualitatively, something like this seems right, but, like, we don't know as of now, you know, like, to answer this type of question. And so what I'm going to tell you about when I tell, like, the actual story will be about, like, our attempts to actually measure this and then answer precisely what you're asking.
The distribution of lengths is not exponential, right? The equilibrium theory would predict that there is a distribution of lengths is exponential.
It's not, as of now, it's certainly not clear one way or another whether that's correct or not.
I'm surprised this is still you're saying this is still a mystery, because, I mean, you can...
Right, and so...
As a theoretician,
yeah.
At least I know that if you attach down into a cargo, label the cargo, you know which direction it will move, so you can actually follow...
No. But here again, like I said, there are, let's say in this large spindle, there are 100,000 microtubules, right? And therefore, and you can't optically resolve them on top of it, right? And so, for example, one thing, and I can't remember if I'm going to come to this again later, but like one thing is that, so these type of pictures, the way these were done, of course, by EM of spindles, right? Which is the best way to really tell what's going on. But the largest spindle that anyone's done a total reconstruction of by electron microscopy is from yeast. And so basically, you know, like, and those spindles are maybe, you know, 2 microns long and have about 40 microtubules. And so those spindles, and this I'll touch on again, those spindles are certainly different from spindles in our cells as well as spindles in these meiotic things. And so I'd say what exactly spindles are like in these larger systems isn't clear. So there are some people who are now trying to do electron tomography to do total EM reconstructions of larger spindles, and we're trying to kind of collaborate, or we are collaborating with those groups to some extent, but that's incredibly challenging. Those are very, very difficult things, right?
And for yeast, what does the result?
And so for yeast. There are about 40 microtubules in the spindle, so it's actually also not really like this, because what it is, it's true that in yeast it's definitely true that all minosins are at the poles, but these kinetochore fibers are actually quite short, and so most of the microtubules in kind of like a metaphase-like state would be kind of these short kinetochore fibers, and then you have a handful of long, what are called interpolar microtubules. That's essentially what the picture is for yeast.
And the forces don't as well?
The forces?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Because obviously forces are incredibly hard to measure in these type of things. Carrie Bloom is interested in these issues, but it's very difficult. So work in the lab, so I'll just kind of give you the overview. So mostly what we're trying to do is trying to do very quantitative measurements of stuff in spindles, and so we compare with some type of theory or simulation to try to understand spindle architecture and dynamics. And so what we do is we develop novel experimental techniques to try to, you know, do those measurements. And we're also very interested in kind of evolution of the spindle. So like I said, spindle different organisms are different, and that's not understood how or why. So just 2 seconds, I'm just going to kind of tell you some like random projects that we're doing, just to kind of, if people are interested, they could come knock, you know, like say hi. And then I'll actually dump into the real thing. Okay, so here's just a 2-second thing. So one thing which we're interested in, so soluble pictures are important to the spindle, so we're trying to develop experimental ways to measure the interactions of soluble molecules all throughout cells, or all throughout the spindle. Like I mentioned, we're collaborating with groups to analyze large-scale electron tomography reconstructions of spindles. And then we're very interested if it's possible to use continuum theories to describe the spindle. Because, you know, like on one hand, maybe the 100,000 microtubules, maybe continuum theory isn't ridiculous. On the other hand, you know, the microtubules aren't, you know, infinitely small, so it's not obvious that it will work. And so that's another thing which we're very interested in.
So what is the plot?
And so the plot is, and so like, and so, and so this is, So if you do quantitative polarized light microscopy on the spindles, you can measure essentially at every location, you can measure what the local director is. And then you can do director-director correlation functions. And then you see they go like 1 over Q squared. And so this is how we're trying to get contact with continuum theories, is basically measure fluctuations of different things, or this kind of, yeah, like, yeah, and see if it can compare with continuum stuff. Okay, and this is just, again, because I'm about to go into other thing, but I'll just show this one slide, but this is just, you know, illustrate the spindles in different organs are different, right? So this is the spindle which people know totally by EM reconstruction, right? This is not the same as like that, right? And it's not just the size, but also shape, right? And dynamics of microtubules. And so we're trying to understand why.
So what are the big differences? Can you summarize them to work? I mean, do you get damage at this scale?
Besides length scale. And so certainly the dynamics of microtubules are very different in different ones. So the sliding, you know, which you saw in the other one, that doesn't exist in all spindles. It actually does, as far as anyone can tell, it doesn't happen in yeast. And so presence or absence, it just grows and shrinks. That's right. That's what seems to be the case. And then the dynamics of the growing and shrinking and turnover is clearly different in different systems. And also, like the speed of anaphase, actually like how the elongation happens, is clearly different in different systems as well. So all of that. I mean, and I could go on. I mean, there's some really interesting and very cool differences that kind of pop up.
Can I ask a stupid question at this point on the phase where the two copies are being pulled apart?
Yes.
So that presumably there the by the type of microtubule that either depolymerize or selectively insert certain movement. Is it known what the system that keeps the poles in mechanical equilibrium? So there must be some other structure which is keeping the poles apart, otherwise they would move together when we try to do the sample.
So the short answer is no. I mean, so amazingly enough, people still like debate this type of stuff. So like, and again, it could be different in different systems, and it could be in any one system a combination of different things. And so certainly in some systems, what happens is it's not just that you have like microtubules like this which get shorter. It's not just like that. Rather, in some systems, it's certainly the case that the middle is actually elongating. And so you actually kind of polymerize stuff in the middle, and that kind of forces the whole things longer. And so even if you don't change the distance of the chromosome to the pole, you still, in fact, get separation. So that's certainly true in some systems. But it also seems to be the case that in other systems, there is some amount of the poles actually interacting with the cell cortex and also being kind of pulled apart from that. And it could be in other systems, not just the cell cortex, but even like kind of other elements in the cytoplasm that the poles may interact with, also involved in these motions. Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right. That's right. But I'd say that's certainly not worked out. I mean, people are just, still study this.
But most of the microtubules are not attached to chromosomes, and so when you separate the chromosomes, most of them are presumably still
So again, so this certainly depends. So for different systems, it's different. So in some systems, there are a lot of guys attached to chromosomes. In other ones, there are very few. So for example, in some systems, it certainly is the case that again, like you have microtubules just in the middle of the spindle. So even forget ones associated with chromosomes, just in the middle, which are polymerizing and expanding the spindle. And so even in that type of system, even if you don't change the distance between the chromosomes and the pole, you still get separation, right? In many systems, of course, you actually do decrease the distance between the chromosomes and the pole. But the exact mechanism by which that happens is still also not well understood. And so it's some amount of, it's not well understood.
And those microtubules that go from one side of membrane to the other side of membrane, how are they actually anchored in the membrane? I'm speaking about the cytoplasmic membrane.
So you're talking about now like an interphase, not in spindle?
How are they anchored there in the membrane?
So I myself certainly don't know of what interactions. I mean, so like certainly this is an active area of research, and I'm sure people do know a lot. I myself do not know. I mean, so like often in these systems, like microtubules interact with dynein is one of the things on the cortex, but like I don't know the details, like an interphase, there's presumably other things as well going on. Okay, all right, okay, so that was intro. I hope, is this like taking ridiculously long? But maybe this is. Should I, I don't know, what's a, I'm happy to go, but like. Yeah, go. Okay, all right, okay, cool. All right, so that's the intro, right? So now we're all like experts on the spindle. So now I'm going to tell you a specific story about, you know, a specific project that we've done. All right, so and so this is about using laser ablation to understand spindle architecture. All right, so we started to try to use laser ablation to look at spindles. We were motivated by two different things. And so one was that people have done a lot of laser ablation of spindles. And so one thing is that under some circumstances, this is kind of a very odd spindle from Diatom, which is more or less a cylinder. And there, if you laser ablate and you cut microtubules, the spindle buckles, right? And so this argues perhaps that, you know, by looking at the deformation which happens when you laser ablate stuff, you might learn about forces involved. And then another observation.
Can you go to the slower spindle here?
Okay, so this spindle here is basically, it's this black region here. So it's more or less this kind of cylinder. And so this is an older paper. And then they went in and they used a laser and they kind of destroyed microtubules here. And then they see that they get some depolymerization of microtubules, but they also see the whole structure buckles. And so they argue that this is due to internal forces and stuff like that. And so we were interested in this type of phenomena.
And it's also suspended in this is the extractive.
No, I'm sorry. This is inside a cell. This is a diatom, which is a small.
So where's the cell boundary?
So these guys are quite large. So this is inside the cell. The diatoms are super cool. They have these glass skeletons. That's really beautiful, but like this is a zoom, and so there's a pole here and a pole here, but the whole cell would be like, I mean, it's be large. And so here actually the chromosomes are actually on the outside of the spindle, they're actually kind of hanging out here, so this is actually different, and so this should be the cartoon. So you have a spindle here and the chromosomes are kind of on the outside, but yeah, life is weird. Right. Well. Okay, yeah. Okay. But I'm just kind of like the motivation here is that we're not the first people to do laser ablation. I just want to like kind of like make you aware of that. All right. And so then like, you know, and again I mentioned before that you can damage stuff and that you can, you know, can heal and stuff. Right. Okay. So actually what we're going to tell you about, is not directly related to either of these, but just showing that other people have been doing this type of stuff before. Right. So what we do is as follows. So like we, in this cell-free system, we take a spindle, you know, with the laser cut a line, right? And then this is observing with a spinning disc confocal microscope.
We're learning
in plane. Oh yeah, I'm sorry. And so yeah, sorry. Yeah, that's right. So it's a plane. So it's about like half a micron by, you know, this varies depending on what we feel like doing, by let's say like 20 microns, and Z is like 1 micron or a couple microns in Z. So it's relatively thin.
So it's not all the way through.
No, it's not all the way through. It's not all the way through, and so it's quite small compared to the length, right? And so what you can see from this is that when you do the cut, so the initial black line, that's just due to bleaching. But then when you do this cut, you see this wave of depolymerization. That's nothing to do with bleaching. It's actually you have depolymerization of microtubules.
That's all in real time, yeah.
No, this is sped up. This whole movie, that's a good question. Let's see. This whole wave that takes about 30 seconds to propagate. So maybe this whole thing would be 30 seconds, yeah. Okay.
And you have similar images with a labeled viewer?
No. So all I'm going to talk about is going to be stuff like this. All right. And so the whole thing is kind of what can we conclude from like this type of thing. Okay. So some of what we do is has been with this is imaging in confocal microscope, but you can also do similar things not in confocal but in wide field, and then just to kind of show you, you see kind of similar results, but the imaging isn't as good. But for a lot of what we're doing, we like just had a wide field microscope. So most of what I'm going to talk about was done with the wide field, not the spinning disc.
So you don't cut it all the way through.
And no.
So it heals automatically in certain seconds, as you said.
That's right. So
you cut it all through, what's happening?
So that we haven't done a lot of. We want to start doing more. There, it takes much longer to heal. So if you really cut, like, let's say, like the whole pull off, it might take like half hour to heal. Well, this kind of very small region is like, you know, 30, you know, maybe like 1 minute, and then you can't tell that you've done anything.
And it heals from outside in?
And so actually this we have not looked at in detail yet, but this is something we were very, very, very interested in.
It's a really stupid question. How do you know it's depolarization? I just see
Loss of intensity?
Yeah, but then it comes back. It's in my eyes.
It does come back.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it does come back. Yeah, and so, but most of what we're talking about is not this coming back part, but just this initial loss of intensity. All right, and so I'll I won't fully answer your question, but I'll say a little bit more, which hopefully will convince you. Because the thing is that people have been cutting microtubules for a long time, so people have an idea of what happens when you cut them. And the basic picture is as follows: that you take a microtubule and you cut it, you know, with a laser or with a glass needle or whatever, you generate a new plus end and a new minus end. And the newly generated plus end rapidly depolymerizes, while the newly generated minus end is more stable, right? And so people have shown that both in purified microtubules, so that's true, that plus ends rapidly depolymerize when you cut them, minus ends are much more stable.
Is it stable or just slow about
depolymerizing? That's not super well looked at. I mean, like, so for example, you can, so I guess like here, yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, it's clearly very, very slow. I mean, like, so it certainly may happen to some extent, definitely. But
compare cut and uncut, would be different.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I'm not sure of actually the kind of the rigorous answer to that. I'm not sure. But just kind of in this very kind of qualitative sense, you cut plus ends and they vanish like super fast. You cut minus, you know, and the new generation minus ends is kind of like hangs out. All right. And this is true, so that's true, if just purified tubule, nothing else that happens, right? It's also true, you can go to like interface cells where you can do very good imaging of microtubules, and you can cut individual microtubules, and you see the exact same thing. And people have argued that the same thing happens in spindles, because people have also cut spindles before. So the physical picture, what we argue is happening, is that we cut a region in the middle, right? You generate new plus ends and new minus ends, and the newly generated plus ends rapidly depolymerize, and that's what this kind of, you know, wave is. So I don't get it. Yeah.
So the test chamber for
food. And so this depends on like how much you end up. And so this depends on when you said well, because of course, like you sort of out of focus, you have light from other guys as well, because you haven't cut the whole thing. Yeah, locally. Well, so that would depend on, I guess, how many guys are facing one way versus the other way. The amount of. No! I'm sorry. I see what you're saying. Because you're always generating. Yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. No. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Right. I was getting ahead of myself. Right. Okay. So another way that you can follow this exact same information is instead of looking at those movies I showed you, you just at every kind of like pixel, you compute the time derivative, right? And so this is kind of like, this is actually the negative of the time derivative, so it's bright in the beginning, right? And so this shows you, this should be like kind of a measure of kind of how much intensity loss you have, or what we argue, how much depolymerization you have. And so you can see like you do the cut, and then you get these kind of, you know, waves of depolymerization which propagate toward the two poles.
If you do a shorter one,
yes. If you do a shorter one, they also just actually like they don't grow or shrink. They basically just propagate directly to the two poles. Okay. And so, all right. So as you can see, stuff is more or less spatially uniform in this direction. So what we do is that we just kind of like average or sum along this direction, and then so we just kind of represent stuff by these 1D plots, right? So the idea is that, so you do a cut, and this is how I'm going to represent everything from now on. So initially after the cut, you have these two kind of like peaks of depolymerization, and then as time progresses, these peaks propagate to the poles.
Constant speed?
Say again, please?
More or less constant speed?
Yes, and I'll come back to the second, but essentially constant speed, that's right. And so, let's see, is that here? No, because I'll come back again in a second. Okay, but the first thing you can notice is that these two peaks don't always initially have the same amplitude, right? The obvious explanation for that would be that, so like, you know, if you cut, you can generate more plus ends on one side than the other side, and that would give you different amplitudes. And that argues that by looking at the relative ratio of these guys, you can measure the local polarity of microtubules.
As a function of z,
exactly. So we cut different regions on the spindle, we measure this polarity, and we see, you know, using this method, in the middle of the spindle, we have 50-50, right? So half guy's pointing one way, half guy's pointing the other way. So this is basically number of microtubules, or fraction of microtubules kind of pointing this way. So as you get toward this pole, most of them are pointing that way. In the middle, it's half and half. And then as you get toward the other pole, there are, you know, most of them are pointing the other way.
It's almost linear.
Second, please?
It's almost linear.
It's almost linear, yeah, or I mean, linear, yeah. I don't know. Yeah. We need to get better data.
How close can you get us to the pole?
Yeah, and so this is one thing, is that we can't get super close to the pole, unfortunately. So we cannot get within a few microns of the pole, because then you can't really see the waves very well. And so everything I'm talking about is not...
So did you say why there ought to be minus ends distributed throughout this window?
Okay, so that so there's a lot of indirect evidence that that's the case. And so like I can name a few things. So one is that the density of when you do this fluorescent imaging, the density is basically uniform everywhere. And so like if in fact all the guys were here, obviously the density would have to be higher here, but experimentally that seems not to be the case. Other observations are stuff like that if you look at the speed of motions of those, you know, like spots like, you know, like you saw before, you can see that stuff moves slower at the poles than in the middle, and so that would be a little hard to interpret if everything was, you can kind of cook up models where that would happen, but like at least the simplest thing is therefore, that literally shows that, so that shows that you can't have just continuous guys going all the way. And other people have done other experiments, just kind of other things which argue that this is the case for these spindles.
But this data doesn't say that, right?
Not yet.
If this speed that you observe consistent with the speed of on the slide which you showed at the very beginning with catastrophe and recovery.
Yes, that's an excellent question. Okay, so let me just come to this one. So I'll just do this next. Okay, so it's peak position. So I'll just answer this one. This was a question before that if you look at the peak position, so this is like three peaks, but you can of course get like, you know, many times, and you see it basically increases linearly. And the speed is about 35 microns a minute. So that's actually faster than the speed of depolarization. So that information, you know, like that data was from microtubules not in the spindle, but you know, going off of a centrosome in the same extract, right? And so this number I think you have to take with kind of a grain of salt, because it doesn't have to be the case that the speed of depolarization induced by a laser cut doesn't have to be the same as kind of the natural speed of depolarization. Because you know, like if proteins are involved in regulating depolarization, you know, like, I mean, it could be different, right?
You also warmed up locally, right? You put some heat, so you speed up a little bit.
Well, and so actually, like, with this type of method, you do very little heating. Frankly, like, the laser physicists confuse me, because it depends on really, like, exactly how you do the pulses and stuff like that. But the way this is done, to kind of, like, the best of my understanding, is that because you have very high pulses, which are spaced apart relatively widely in time, heat dissipates quite rapidly, and rather what you have is you have essentially like you locally create like a plasma, and you really like blow apart everything that's there.
And
the substance.
I'm sorry, you said something, and then on the slide it doesn't seem to agree. The microtubule depolarization in the low density experiments is consistent with this or not?
It's not. And so like that is around, so like that speed, so if you look at the individual microtubule and you watch that grow and shrink, yes, there the depolarization, this is in the same extract far removed from the spindle, the speed of depolarization is around 10 microns per minute.
Okay.
That's slower than this, right? There are two possible explanations
so
for that.
Should that lower number be 10? I'm confused about what's in your slide.
Oh no. So this is in this experiment, this is 35 microns a minute. Yes. Okay.
And so the factor three.
Yeah, right. And so there are two possible explanations for that. One is that being in the spindle makes microtubules depolarize at a faster rate, you know, because somehow the environment's locally regulated. Or two, being cut by a laser is different from kind of normally depolarizing. Somehow when you cut by a laser, like, you know, like the process by which you depolarize isn't the same. Because if there were proteins at the tip, you know, so personally that's kind of the explanation I favor, because I could just hypothetically imagine if there are proteins at the tip helping you depolarize, that's different than if you, you know, cut it with a laser, but it's not known.
From the previous picture, you can get density events,
right? Come to that.
Seems to be constant.
I'm exactly going to that.
But I don't understand this argument why this speed is different from the other one, because
Okay, so
explain it. Laser only initiates the process, and then the process develops its constant speed far away from the place
you
where
should, you should forget.
Yeah.
With the laser, you really fry the proteins locally. While in the spontaneous, just one, I was thinking about this also. In one case, you fry the protein, and it's possible that they don't disassemble in as optimal ways as one would.
But it affects a very small fraction of proteins, very locally. But once it moves far away. But it's those are gone, and the ones that are depolarized later is the sort of the part of the microtubule that we know about.
It's still stuck on the microtubule, just being
It's not like the microtubule is moving away. It's the things falling off. So the part is falling off. They don't even know that far away, 10 microns away, something was fried.
No, but if you fry something at some place of the microtubule, it's not said that it goes away. It might as well stick.
But that's what I asked.
But there could be associated proteins that could help the depolarization.
Yeah.
If you cut it.
That gets the wrong sign.
This is faster. Well, no, sort of, but yeah, they could break. Yeah, they could slow it down. Yeah.
What's the variance on the slower speed?
Oh, yeah, and so yeah, and so I mean, like for the isolated measurements, I mean, like it's frankly pretty shitty. I mean, like because you know whatever, like every microtubule is different, right? Their microtubule, but I would say like I mean it's not this high. I mean, like I don't think that you can reconcile. The individual micro, you know, measurements.
Can't you just cut microtubule in vitro in the absence of a spindle and do the control?
And so.
That's a very different system.
Yeah, but okay, so.
Get this number.
Yeah.
But it's slower.
Well, yeah, so I don't know what. Okay, so people have certainly cut microtubules in vitro, and I'm sure they've measured how fast they depolarize.
What's the number you really want to know to compare this
to? Then you can argue whether. Yeah, okay. That's...
So there's much more tension here. So it's essentially not a free depolarization, it's a depolarization under force, and it's faster.
No,
I don't think, yeah.
There's no force.
Yeah.
But it's not free, and they're connected from motor proteins to each other, so it's a kind of a bundle. It's not a free.
The hand is free. The microtubule
right, but it's closed. That here they connected through its network.
The microtubules are connected, but the antibody that's falling off is not connected.
You don't know
right,
if it's
but
falling
it,
off, Michael.
Exactly.
If you fry a microtubule in a spindle, you can't be sure that you disintegrate, that you take off this part that you fry, that you.
I mean, yeah, no, I mean, that seems a little hard, yeah.
If I'm cutting something off here and I'm in the middle of the process and I'm now depolarizing 10 microns away, how does that part of microtubule know that something was cut off earlier?
It's
the
speed
of forest fire should not 10 kilometers from the place where someone dropped a cigarette. Doesn't depend on which kind of cigarette was in the beginning.
Unless there's a firefighter on the floor, or walking with the fire extinguisher.
You're saying
you're
going along with the cut.
Well, the point is that ends are different and not as manipulatable, perhaps, by accessory factors as they would normally be.
Which ends?
Of the microtubules that you cut or not cut. I don't know if you can say cut, actually.
So you're saying that there's something stays with the end in a normal way that it would always be at the end, and here this object is not there.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think that's a real possibility.
Diffusion rates of proteins and the slow depolarization. It's perfectly possible for a little cloud associated with proteins to follow at the end.
Why they should follow exactly the end?
Because they would bind to it.
But also end tracking.
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly ones which are known 100% to track the growing plus ends.
But the control, again, is really simple. In vitro, a naked microtubule, right?
Yeah. No, we should see. Yeah. Okay. So Okay. So the other thing is that you can see that the area of the peaks decrease with time, and this is related to what was mentioned before.
That's not symmetric.
So again, and it's not symmetric. That's right. So both those points are very interesting, right?
Accuracy is symmetric.
Say again.
Within the accuracy of the experiment.
No. Well, okay. So I mean, here you could argue. I mean, like, well, like. Okay, this is look. Well, no. This looks faster than that, right? I think that's pretty clear. But nonetheless, I mean, I'll show you more data.
But the rate of decrease is similar on both sides, or
it's different.
Okay.
And so here's okay. So for any place like the area decays exponentially, you know, to the accuracy of our measurement, right? Exponentially, the exponential decay, but it depends on how far you're away from the pole. So it's like if you do a cut here, right? You have one cut which is kind of close to this pole, and the other cut is far away from that other pole. So if you know, like, look at distance to the pole that you're close to, So for, you know, if you're very far away, you have a very slow decay. And if you're very close to a pole, you have a very rapid decay.
If the rate depends on the distance, then it should not be exponential because it should be a function e to the t over tau, where tau
no, is independent. No, because this is position of the cut. And so it depends on the initial position of the cut. So you cut at one location, and then you see this decay.
So it remembers.
It remembers where it was cut.
Which is consistent with this higher velocity.
I'm not sure.
Higher velocity indicates that it does remember how it was.
Oh, so you're saying like, yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. Okay, yeah. So no, but like there's also kind of a simple explanation. Well, and I'll come to that in a second. Like why this makes sense, remembers where it was cut. But like, okay, but like let's just kind of focus just on empirical stuff. So you can look at, if you consider microtubules pointing in, let's say, this direction away from a pole, you can look at 1 over this decay length as a function of like how far away you are. And so near the pole, it's very small, right? Near the pole. It's the half, you know, it's the length scale associated with this exponential.
I thought you were talking about time.
In some sense, based on one way you could think about it, I mean, so like this could be either, well, right, and so.
Since velocity, exactly.
You can kind of, it's the same.
Velocity is the same in both directions?
Yeah, velocity is the same in both directions. And so like, and so in some sense it's the same, right? Or if you want to be kind of more like, you know, rigorous about it, then you could just say, okay, we look at a point on the spindle, which is a certain distance from the cut. But you can interconvert with, you know, there's a constant velocity. So rapid decay close to the pole, right? As you get far away from the pole, a slow decay.
What is it? And what's the function for?
And so this we have not fit this with anything in particular, but this is kind of the data. So maybe I'll let me just kind of.
This is for which kind of spindles, because they have very, very different shapes. So
that's right. This will totally depend on the type of spindle. This is for this kind of spindle in this frog egg extract. That's right. And so for different spindles, it'll be different, definitely. Definitely. Say again, please.
So it looks like a problem of density in microtubules, because at the pole side, there are more squids than the.
Right, so actually the density is the same, but it is related to the type of thing which you're talking about right now. In other words, this has something to do with the organization of microtubules in the spindle. Exactly. I'll try to just go to this. And so the first thing I just want to just address this, like, just, so you might ask, like, well, why do you have less depolymerization over time? Why does this peak area decrease over time? And you could hypothetically imagine two mechanisms. And so one is that if you have, you know, like, ends throughout, you cut, and then you depolymerize all the way to your end, and then you can't depolymerize more than, you know, so you're gone. Or the other thing is that you cut, you depolymerize, and then you change to a non-depolymerizing state, you rescue. So just very briefly, I'll just say, like, we know that this isn't what's happening. And so just kind of trust me. I can tell you guys if you wanna. I'm just trying to like speed stuff up, but like I don't have a slide on it, but I can tell you how we know it's not happening. But we know that in this spindle it's not happening.
But you can currently already measure the density events from your first experiment, so you can check this.
So one hasn't measured the density of. Oh! You're saying by association where those guys are? Yes. Okay. So
the slope of your function of asymmetry was the density event.
Well, no. I'm sorry. Of slope of the function.
You were showing the asymmetry of the peak as a function of.
No. So yeah. So excellent. Very good. So it's all right. So let me come back to that. So all right. So I mean, like, if in fact this is going on, if it's only this and not this, then things become very simple. And so, please blindly believe me that this isn't happening. But if you care enough to ask me afterwards, then I'll tell you why I think that's the case. But for now, just to keep the talk semi-finite.
It's semi-final because it started the final distance.
Oh, right. That's true. Okay, so but this is the point. Okay, so like even though, okay, so even if, okay, so so we were excited by this once we figured out that this wasn't happening. We were like, aha, this is awesome. We're just going to figure out where all the microtubules are, and we're done, and we're happy, right? But it's actually a little more complicated than that. And the reason it's more complicated than that is that because the shape of the decay depends on both the length and the organization. And you can see that just by this one very simple argument. Is that so? Imagine you have a bunch of guys which are all the same length. And if they all start at their minus end, you cut them. If they all depolymerize to the minus end, then you have a constant, you know, and then it would go to zero. But if the guys are the same length, were just kind of spread at random, you would cut them and you have a linear decrease. And so clearly the decay depends on both the lengths and the organization.
Do you know organization from that experiment?
Well,
from your symmetry.
Because
it was that, when you cut it, would be symmetric, and you know the symmetry depends on position.
Okay, yes, right, no, exactly. So, exactly. So perhaps I'm saying the same thing in a different way than you are, but like, because by combining information from different ones, you can figure everything out. Exactly, that's right. No, exactly. And so, because basically, I mean, the way I think about it, which is a slightly different value you're wearing, but I think it's essentially the same thing, is that if you imagine a cut from here, you see a certain amount of decays. You imagine a cut from here, you see a different decay profile. And so these could be different if you have guys whose plus ends are in between them, and therefore you don't cut those, right? And so basically, so you can kind of formalize this, I won't go into the details, but essentially, by looking at these differences in decays, whatever related to this, you can get at every location, the density of plus ends whose length, you know, of a certain length, right? So you get kind of everything. And then from this, right, then one says that actually the lengths at all locations are in fact exponential, but the actual lengths depend on where you are. And so near the pole, you're short, far away from the pole, you're long, but it's always exponential distribution.
So the average length is linear
with the pole? And so it's flat here, then kind of like, you know, increases, and this flat thing is real. Yeah. Okay. So it's some complicated thing. Okay. So I feel bad because it's like I feel like I'm taking too much time, but I also want to finish. Like, and so I'm going to try to like.
Oh, don't feel bad.
Don't feel bad. Okay. I'm going to try to keep you here as long as possible, and no like breaks for the bathroom. Okay. Right. So then we started to wonder, okay, so like why are microtubules actually short at the poles, right? So this is microtubules.
Because this is if you do a linear fit, it's actually you have an excess.
And so I mean like
probably what Dan wants to explain the major term.
You're talking about that dependence or the difference?
Well, okay, so what I would say is that, so like here, okay, like this is like kind of the stupidest thing, right? Is that here I say the mean length is 2 microns, here I say the mean length is something longer, right? It's like, you know, 12 microns or 13 microns.
Where's the middle?
And so the middle is right here, 25, or around here, I think 20.
So why is it asymmetric left triangle?
Yeah. And so
this are only the ones that are pointing.
This is the only ones that are pointing this one direction, exactly.
And the other ones
would be in the other direction. It would be kind of mirror symmetric. Exactly. So these are the length of guys who are pointing in this direction away from this pole, away from the pole at zero. And so these guys are tend to be short here and long here. And then we want. Right. And so, right. Okay. So this is a subtle point in you are a smart person. So this I didn't go into because you could mean length. So in a case like this, like what you mean by length is actually somewhat confusing because you could talk about length from plus ends or length from minus ends or average length which cross a point. And so it ends up by any of those measures, they actually are shorter at the poles than you'd kind of expect. But it is a subtle point, exactly what you're saying, because in some sense, if you just want length from plus ends, it's not surprising that they get longer because you have kind of more room for them to be. right? But even taking that into account, they're actually shorter at the poles than you'd expect. Yeah, does that, I don't know if people, everyone kind of followed that, because it is a little bit kind of a subtle point. But so it's still true that they are shorter the poles. Okay, so we're trying to consider different models. So one thing which we're thinking that you have some type of spatially varying stabilization, that in some region the lengths of microtubules are kind of artificially increased in some mechanism, and so the strong prediction would be that microtubules outside of the spindle should be shorter than microtubules inside the spindle if that were the case, right? I'll tell you the answer, and then I'll show you like. That was the first answer. No, it's not the case.
Did you use? You said at some point that the internal density, the spindle would be roughly constant, and so you need longer and shorter ones to just fill this thing.
Yes.
Did you use this already, or?
Right.
You have uniform density filled with just constant pencils? You don't have to. I mean, you're right, it's happening, but
you can fix them
like.
Right.
Yeah.
Our pencils
are long
enough.
You know,
they're not. I mean, the ends that are.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. The ends are all throughout, right?
But the distribution of plus and minus ends are not uniform.
That's right.
And so are you going to talk about the distribution? Because that's the answer for this question.
Well, I'll come back to that later on. Yeah, and so
the density of constant is constant, but plus and minus is changed.
Exactly. That's correct. So this model is wrong, and basically the way that we tell is that we basically generate microtubules in the same extract system far removed from a spindle by using what's called essentially like the skeleton of a microorganism, which has all these microtubule nucleating sites all over it. And you throw it into extract, and it's like microtubules go all over the place. And then we just do the same cutting experiment. And then from these microtubules, so not in the spindle, and we see that the lengths we get are basically the same as in the longest regions, right? Okay, so that means that it's not like the long ones are kind of long. It's that the short ones are short. So it's not this kind of spatial varying stabilization. So we thought of two other models. One is that you have enhanced destabilization at poles, right? That makes them shorter. Or another model is that if you just have spatially varying nucleation with transport, you can get shorter guys at the poles. And the reason why, essentially, is because imagine you have more nucleation in the middle, and then you guys are moving to the poles. If at kind of any given region, imagine you're at some region, you have guys who are nucleated at that region, and the guys who kind of came to that region who are nucleated somewhere else. If the guys who came here and nucleated somewhere else are shrinking because they're old and they're depolymerizing, then you can in fact get guys which are shorter, even though you don't have any regularization of stability. Right, so that's kind of another potential model.
And you need more region which is far from the poles, which is what you've got.
Yes, that's right. That's correct. No, exactly. That's correct. Okay, and so then these are the two models that we're now gonna.
Can you separate them?
Yes. So the first thing that we did is that we thought, okay, let's kind of like really like analyze the consequences of these models, and so let's do like a super stupid simple model of microtubule dynamics and spindles. And so we know that there's sliding in the spindle, right, which is roughly at 2 microns a minute, right? It's more complicated, but let's just take it. Guys move to the pole at 2 microns per minute, right? Guys polymerize. We know the rate of polymerization because their proteins which track polymerizing ends, and you can measure that's 10 microns a minute. They depolymerize. We can get a range for depolymerization that's kind of semi-reasonable. And then we say, okay, so on one condition, we're going to consider the following model, that we have spatially varying catastrophe but constant nucleation. So we just pretend nucleation is kind of uniform everywhere, but you have spatially varying catastrophe.
Make VT as a function of Z.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. So catastrophe is the rate of conversion from polymerizing to depolymerizing.
Not changing
any of these things. So keeping all of these fixed, but then just having this kind of rate of switching, right? Or have this rate of switching constant, and have spatially varying, no, I'm sorry, spatially varying, have this rate of cadastrality constant and then spatially varying nucleation, right? So to be just super simple, so this is, you know, like the density of polymerizing ends who have X and a length L, and this is the density of depolymerizing ends who have a length L and are at X. So just a super simple 1D model. And then we can just say, all right, so can we think of functions for the spatially varying catastrophe or functions for the spatially varying nucleation, which can explain our data? And the answer for both is yes. And so it's possible. So you can postulate some spatially varying catastrophe rate, which you know explains this length distribution, and you can postulate some spatially varying nucleation rate, which also explains this length distribution, right? So either model could, in theory, explain the data, right? But the prediction for what microtubules are actually doing in the two models is very, very different, right? And so then we can ask, like, you know, can we test that with other measurements? So for example, because the polymerization dynamics are actually very different. So for example, you can measure turnover by doing a spiking experiment. So like you have spindles in this extract, and they're normally like, let's say, have like green tubulin around, right? And then you suddenly add red tubulin and you ask, where does it incorporate, right? And so we look in a little region in a spindle, and you would see that, all right, so in experimentally you incorporate more in the middle, right, and then it eventually kind of like fills out to the poles. If you had spatially varying nucleation, based on this kind of profile which we fit previously, that's exactly what you'd predict, right? Because you have more nucleation in the middle, therefore guys get rapidly incorporated there. But if you had in fact spatially varying catastrophe and constant nucleation, you have more rapid turnover at the poles, therefore you would expect kind of more guys to get incorporated there, and that's not what you observe, right?
Do you know that monomeric concentration of tubulin is uniform along your pole spindle, or it?
Oh, and so
the nucleation profile.
Say again, please, like that.
So I would argue that catastrophe is an internal property of microtubules that should be uniform, but nucleation is a property of concentration of two monomers.
Oh.
So if it's not uniform, that you would expect varying nucleation is to be more reasonable.
Well, no. I believe that either one of these, if either one were correct, it would certainly be spatial variation of other proteins which are influencing these behaviors. So it would not be just monomeric stuff. That's a very interesting question, actually. That has not been directly measured in the spindle. What's the actual concentration of monomer?
Well, tubulin is a critical thing. It means something else, but without tubulin, there's no way to nucleate.
That's correct. That's correct.
And was there depolymerization would be similar, or if you just have spatially varying depolymerization?
So this is the spatially varying depolymerization.
This was switching.
Switch. Yeah, this is switch. Okay, and by, like rates.
Just rates at the end.
I guess naively, I'd have to think about that. Naively, I would expect it be, in some sense, it would be similar to this in the sense of, because you're saying that they'd be faster. You're saying that there are guys shorter here because they're more dynamic, basically.
Well, just, the hands get shorter, faster, or slower, depending on that you have this.
I'd have to think about that. That's not.
It sounds like it's going to be similar to the middle one.
To middle one.
If you look at the equations.
Yeah. I mean, I should say, we certainly know that the rate of polymerization is not spatially varying.
Yeah, depolymerization,
that I don't know. I'd have to think about that. Right, so, I mean, whatever, this is just, I won't show that, okay. And then similarly, like, you can look at, like concentration of growing plus ends, right? So there's a protein which labels specifically growing plus ends, and basically, like, if you have spatially varying nucleation, you expect more growing plus ends in the middle. If spatially varying catastrophe, you basically expect, you know, plus ends all throughout. And so, in fact, experimentally, we and other people have observed that there's, you know, more spatial, there's enrichment of, and here this is kind of more kind of a line plot. So this is experiment of density of EB1, which is a supposedly a measure for growing plus ends, and then, you know, you'd expect with this variation nucleation model that it's enriched in the middle, just like it is, right? So both of those things argue for this spatially varying nucleation model, and then this can explain this variation in lengths, this incorporation, location of growing plus ends, and now they come to this minus, you know, this ends bit, and so like here's a prediction. So this is actually quite noisy. But like the experimental prediction for the number of plus ends and the ratio plus end to minus ends at different regions. And this same model, like more or less, I mean, like, you know, yeah, capture that, even though it's errors with, you know, measurements, a lot of error. And so one thing that you're right, and then it's like based on EM data, you can actually put actual numbers here. Like this is like the prediction for numbers of plussens per cubic micron. And so, so this is a prediction that if someone actually goes in and does like EM, right, that, you know, this is what they should measure.
What is the functional form? Is it exponential?
And so this we haven't fit. It certainly looks exponential to me, but.
It's Bauer law than exponential.
First point is correct.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is the model, is the blue, and the model goes down, but we don't have actual data to show that. Yeah.
Could be an exponential city on the desert. It's too flat. It's not exponential because it doesn't go to zero.
Right, okay. Yeah, that's true.
Or zero should be.
Yeah, I mean, like, I wouldn't go too much. I mean, like, this, yeah. I wouldn't like fit it to death. but still, I mean, it's actually in the measurement of it, even if it has large error bars. And so, yeah, it's almost linear. I mean, like, it looks like it levels off. Yeah. That's right. And so, okay, this is just the last thing, right? And this is just like, we went through like what we thought would be the killer experiment to test if this is right. So this whole model is based on spatial variationization with transport, right? So it's a transport here is important, right? And so we want to say, so the prediction would be if you reduce transport, then you would actually, you could actually increase length of microtubules because of the sliding. So this is actually an interesting point. Yeah, exactly. So when people see this kind of motion of tubulin, and if you look in textbook, they often refer to this as treadmilling. And so again, treadmilling would be if you have a polymer here and a guy gets incorporated there and a guy falls off there. I actually believe it's not that. It's really that you essentially have microtubules, and again, this isn't proven, but this is what I believe. I think there's evidence for it, but whatever. So you actually have a microtubule whose minus end is more or less static, growing and shrinking by the plus end, and the whole thing physically being transported. So I believe that's what the motion is. And so not kind of actual treadmilling of individual filaments.
The motors.
Yeah, exactly. So it'd be the motors which are kind of physically transporting relatively, you know, essentially shorter microtubules.
It's quite slow, 2.5 microns per minute.
Yeah.
So dynein, for example, works 1 micron per second.
Right, no, so this is
single one.
This is also called Kinesin 5 is thought to be the one which is driving this. And in vitro, it's more or less similar speeds. It's a slow motor.
But if you do more convection, more diffusion, you probably will change the transport. Because you will make everything uniform. Because nucleation should depend on some chemicals or some proteins.
But transport is just the speed at which.
Right. I'm talking about the nucleation rate. Nucleation rate should depend on some factors. And this, if you do more, mix it up, make it more uniform, then you should decrease it.
Well, yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, like, it's actually like, I mean, like, we are trying to measure, you know, like actually what soluble factors are doing, because like, you know, like there's, you know, people argue that soluble factors are like really important, and so we're actually doing like a concerted effort to do that. But even though we're doing that, I'm becoming more and more convinced that actually a lot of the spatial stuff may not be soluble factors, but actually spatial stuff due to cytoskeletal, you know, like interact, right? In which case, like shaking up stuff, yeah, won't really affect much.
Or the spindle scale.
Well, yeah, well.
So I have a question which is a little confusing to me.
Yeah.
You probably reject the words stabilizing.
I'm sorry.
You probably reject any stabilizing activity being important here in your model. However, how strictly can you really distinguish between the act of nucleation and any stabilizing component? Because nucleation will include stabilization. So what exactly is the definition of nucleation?
So I would say like nucleation is the generation of kind of, okay, let's say like generation of polymer of zero length or something like that, right? Well, then stabilization would be referring to what the polymer does after it's born. And so like, you know, fooling with kind of the behavior of the polymer The actual behavior product and then the rate it's generated have very different consequences for you know, a wide variety of things.
And what is then exactly the definition of nucleation? Is it how many? I don't see that there's a clear definition yet that you could.
How many new?
How long is a microtubule that has been nucleated?
Well, and so people don't know the answer to that, but like in some sense, if one wanted like a rigorous answer to that, like I would argue that like if you measure the dynamics of a long microtubule, and they have some certain dynamics which isn't length dependent, which we think there isn't, then what's the shortest microtubule which has those same dynamics? And then you know like your kind of rate that you generate those guys is your nucleation rate, you know, like so something like that.
Because my sense is you continuously, spontaneously generate small precursors.
Right, and so like I would call that all nucleation. That would all be nucleation.
Because there's also stabilizing components, and I just feel there's
Well, but there you're kind of stabilizing nuclei as opposed to like stabilizing like you know polymer.
It's like gradual transition.
Well, no, but again, but the consequences are really quite different.
He has a mathematical. You can answer it because you wrote up some.
Yeah, and then that it's literally polymer of zero length.
And there are differential equations which answer your question. So.
No, but in reality, inside the extract,
it would kind of be zero.
You need some stabilizing component.
But it would be the answer which I just gave. That would be that like the shortest microtubule that behaves like a long microtubule. Yeah. That's the thing.
I'm just reacting to your strong rejection of stabilizing. The word stabilizing.
How do you mathematically describe stabilizing?
Well, that's the question. How do you biologically?
No, but mathematically, I mean, you have an equation described the birth, growth, and decay of microtubules. A mathematical equation that have nucleation, growth, and decay. How you get it, another term that you call stabilization?
Well, stabilization could be a lack of disassembly, for example.
But that's already there. Because
yeah,
you have an equation.
That is a matter of semantics.
Right. So it's only really included. In the nucleation, growth, and decay, stabilization is part of those three. Okay, so don't need a fourth there.
Yeah, but nevertheless, it's firmly crossed out any contribution of stabilization. That's why I
think it's a question of language.
Yeah, no, yeah, I think so.
Which is, however, important in the field, because there are people who are claiming that stabilization is one big part of it, others claim that it's nucleation.
Yeah, but I'm still mathematically defined what you mean. I don't think you can discuss it.
That's why I was asking what exactly the definition of nucleation is.
Maybe the question is whether it is related to rates or the size of critical nucleus. The size of minimal thing that you set up behaves like long
So what do you think the biochemistry would be of this, you know, the size? I mean, size big enough to make a cap or something like that?
No, and so I mean, and like I was saying before, I mean, I think the thing we know least about is nucleation, and so like, and this I would count as this. I mean, so like, and so. I would say we don't know in purified tubulin, you know, like what this process is like. And so one could imagine, you know, like you first kind of somehow form some sheet-like structure that has to like close up. And then if that was what's happening, you can imagine proteins would have different proteins could have different roles. Some could help you close up, some could help you elongate, right? But I would say we don't know any of that really. I mean, like one of the difficulties is it's very hard to, and so like, you know, so you might say like, oh, you just do a genetic screen and find out what all the nucleators are, but that's like, really hard in the following sense that like you can do a genetic screen and you can knock up some protein and so you don't have microtubules, but that's not obvious that you found a nucleator. Well, and so like so it's not at all, you know what I mean, like there are kind of multiple interpretations of that, so it's
no idea of the critical length. I mean, is it
there is some theory, a few arguments that there are two layers of
like, yeah, like
that's enough for you for nucleation, but he's right, it's very limited amount of work.
There are ways of measuring it using scattering and solutions of fibula.
Yeah, so people have done some of that, but like only under kind of very limited circumstances, and like
two layers is like 2 nanometers, and they're like on the level of resolution.
I'm talking about solutions separately.
People did this experiment, you know, and they argue that it's beyond the resolution. So maybe there is some cluster, but they say it's smaller than.
No, I'm not talking about the structure factor. I'm talking about the principle. You can move more than one intensity from that.
From what I've seen, we cannot get any information.
No, I presume you're talking about basically you like look at like amount of stuff that you like grow as a function of stuff you've added and these type of stuff. Yeah, people have done some of that, but not actually surprisingly not a huge amount.
The size would probably be completely different if you have a protein that's helping to stabilize.
Of course.
Yeah. No. Totally. Yeah. Totally. And again, like that's none of that's understood.
Then I understood the debate. So I think what she's saying is nucleation is an uphill battle, and if there are these catastrophic events that always kill you before you're up to the top, of course, that's bad.
Right.
Now, so if before, I mean, if the critical size is so large that this thing is actually already a long polymer, and if the same catastrophe event which kills the long ones is already active during before the thing is considered as nucleation, then there's a problem in disentangling the two, because if you stabilize these ends, you also help with nuclearization. While if this thing is short, and if what creates catastrophes during the nuclearization process is different from the catastrophes that occur when the polymer is long, then you can treat these as two different phenomena, which you can independently manipulate from a more microscopic point of view.
Yeah, no. So I think you're correct. I mean, it certainly may be the case that there are factors which both influence nucleation and influence growth, you know, like, but still like in kind of some, and so it could be that in reality, when you like change protein X, you're kind of screwing up both these things, but still like, you know, I think in some abstract sense, of course, you can kind of conceptually separate them, even if it's, I mean, there certainly are factors which are involved in nucleation.
Yeah. Could be some single phenomenon
control both grades.
So,
So how would you explain the stabilized microtubule length? You showed actually extracts that it goes spontaneously, not from any centrosome and so on. Let's say you get 20 microns plus right. minus half a micron right. fluctuations.
Right.
Doesn't fall with this.
That it's not at all obvious, and so like what I would argue is, and this is kind of cheating, right? Because I'm putting everything to like the part we don't know, and so I would argue basically it's that somehow it's the control of the spatial profile of nucleation which is really the important thing for setting the size of the spindle, and so somehow like you know like what tells you you know the process which says oh nucleate more here and less here and less here, that's the thing which is setting the size of the thing which is fundamentally like you know determining the whole structure. So not so much like these other things you can imagine, but we haven't said much about the mechanism of that. And so I'm basically done. I mean, like, well, I'll just say one more thing, which is that, like, well, we do this experiment and it's correct. So I'm done. so that's like the very short thing is that you can like inhibit transport in spindles.
Let's listen to
that. Okay, so this is just like 2 seconds, and then we're all set, and then you're free. And so basically, so like you know, normal spindles, you have a speed of you know, what builds up flux, this transport of around 2.3 micron, you know, 2.5 microns a minute. If you inhibit two different motors, you have more or less you have structures which more or less have the same size and shape as regular spindles, but the rate of transport is strongly reduced. And so then we can just do our cutting experiment again. So in our hands, we get like around 0.6 microns. And then we can just do our cutting experiment again, and that we see like instead of seeing this, you know, like very short decay near pole in a doubly embedded spindle, we see a much longer decay, which is kind of consistent with the prediction. So like just by inhibiting transport, you affected the length of guys there because you affected, you know, this kind of sorting mechanism. And so that's also consistent. And so now thinking about length, and so this is, I've done a little kind of like, you know, underhanded thing, switching to length from minus ends. And so if you look at length from minus ends, the typical length that you see experimentally is around, you know, whatever, 6.5 microns, again, exponential. And if you just kind of use this model and predict if you totally stopped flux, what you'd expect, and it's this blue line. And so it's basically an agreement. So the gist of it is that, well, here, I'll just do the conclusion very quickly, that like, so I think microtubules are shorter at poles. Even though polymerization and depolymerization are spatially uniform because of just the spatially varying nucleation combined with transport. And transport is just somehow locally sorting microtubules and giving this weird pattern. But there's still a lot more to do, and those are complicated.